There was a car standing outside Sanssouci bearing the word police on it. Absorbed in her own thoughts, Tuppence took little notice of that. She turned in at the drive and, entering the front door, went straight upstairs to her own room. She stopped, taken aback on the threshold, as a tall figure turned away from the window. "Dear me," said Tuppence. "Sheila?" The girl came straight towards her. Now Tuppence saw her more clearly, saw the blazing eyes deep set in the white, tragic face. Sheila said, "I'm glad you've come. I've been waiting for you." "What's the matter?" The girl's voice was quiet and devoid of emotion. She said, "They have arrested Carl."
"The police?"
"Yes." "Oh dear," said Tuppence. She felt inadequate to the situation. Quiet as Sheila's voice had been, Tuppence was under no apprehension as to what lay behind it. Whether they were fellow conspirators or not, this girl loved Carl von Deinem, and Tuppence felt her heart aching in sympathy with this tragic young creature. Sheila asked, "What shall I do?" A simple, forlorn question made Tuppence wince. She said helplessly, "Oh, my dear." Sheila said, and her voice was like a mourning harp,
"They've taken him away. I shall never see him again."
She cried out, "What shall I do? What shall I do?" And flinging herself down on her knees by the bed, she wept her heart out. Tuppence stroked the dark head. She said presently in a weak voice,
It may not be true. Perhaps they're only going to intern him. After all, he is an enemy alien, you know."
"Well, that's not what they said. They're searching his room now," Tuppence said slowly.
"Well, if they find nothing..."
"Well, they will find nothing, of course. What should they find?"
"I don't know. I thought perhaps you might."
"I?" Her scorn, her amazement, were too real to be feigned. Any suspicions Tuppence had had that Sheila Perenna was involved died at this moment. The girl knew nothing, had never known anything. Tuppence said,
"If he is innocent," Sheila interrupted her,
"what does it matter? The police will make a case against him." Tuppence said sharply,
"Nonsense, my dear child, that really isn't true. The English police will do anything. My mother says so."
"Your mother may say so, but she's wrong. I assure you that it isn't so." Sheila looked at her doubtfully for a minute or two. Then she said,
"Very well, if you say so. I trust you."
Tuppence felt very uncomfortable. She said sharply,
"You trust too much, Sheila. You may have been unwise to trust Carl. Are you against him too? I thought you liked him. He thinks so too."
Touching young things with their faith in one's liking for them. And it was true, she had liked Carl. She did like him. Rather wearily, she said,
"Listen, Sheila, liking or not liking has nothing to do with facts. This country, Germany, are at war. There are many ways of serving one's country. One of them is to get information and to work behind the lines. It is a brave thing to do, for when you are caught, it is..."
Her voice broke a little. "The end." Sheila said,
"You think Carl might be working for his country that way? It is a possibility, isn't it?"
"No," said Sheila.
"It would be his job, you see, to come over here as a refugee, to appear to be violently anti-Nazi and then to gather information."
Sheila said quietly,
"It's not true. I know Carl. I know his heart and his mind. He cares most for science, for his work, for the truth and the knowledge in it. He is grateful to England for letting him work here. Sometimes, when people say cruel things, he feels German and bitter, but he hates the Nazis always, and what they stand for, their denial of freedom."
Tuppence said,
"He would say so, of course."
Sheila turned reproachful eyes upon her.
"So, you believe he is a spy?" "I think it is,"
Tuppence hesitated,
"a possibility."
Sheila walked to the door.
"I see. I'm sorry I came to ask you to help us. But what did you think I could do, dear child? Well, you know people. Your sons are in the army and navy, and I've heard you say more than once that they know influential people. I thought perhaps you could get them to do something."
Tuppence thought of those mythical creatures, Douglas and Raymond and Cyril.
"I'm afraid," she said, that they couldn't do anything. Sheila flung her head up. She said passionately, "Then there's no hope for us. They'll take him away and shut him up, and one day, early in the morning, they'll stand him against a wall and shoot him, and that will be the end." She went out, shutting the door behind her. "Oh, damn, damn, damn the Irish," thought Tuppence, in a fury of mixed feelings. "Why have they got that terrible power of twisting things until you don't know where you are? If Carl von Dynam's a spy, he deserves to be shot. I must hang on to that, not let this girl bewitch me into thinking it's the tragedy of a hero and a martyr." She recalled the voice of a famous actress speaking a line from Riders to the Sea. "It's the fine, quiet time they'll be having." Poignant. Carrying you away on a tide of feeling. She thought, if it weren't true. Oh, if only it weren't true. Yet, knowing what she did, how could she doubt? The fisherman on the end of the old pier cast his line and reeled it cautiously in. "No doubt whatever, I'm afraid," he said. "You know," said Tommy, "I'm sorry about it. He's a nice chap." "They are, my dear fellow, they usually are. It isn't the skunks and the rats of a land who volunteer to go to the enemy's country. It's the brave men. We know that well enough, but there it is. The case is proved." "No doubt whatever, you say?" "No doubt at all. Among his chemical formulae was a list of people in the factory to be approached, as possible fascist sympathizers. There was also a very clever scheme of sabotage and a chemical process that, applied to fertilizers, would have devastated large areas of food stocks. All well up Master Carl's street." Rather unwillingly, Tommy said, secretly anathematizing Tuppence, who had made him promise to say it, "I suppose it's not possible that these things could have been planted on him." Mr. Grant smiled, rather a diabolical smile. "Oh," he said, "your wife's idea, no doubt." "Well, yes, as a matter of fact, it is." "He's an attractive lad," said Mr. Grant tolerantly. Then he went on, "No, seriously, I don't think we can take that suggestion into account. He's got a supply of secret ink, you know. That's a pretty good clinching test. But it wasn't obvious, as it would have been if planted. It wasn't the mixture to be taken when required on the washhand stand or anything like that. In fact, it was damned ingenious. I only came across the method once before, and then it was waistcoat buttons. Steeped in the stuff, you know. When the fellow wants to use it, he soaks the button in water. Carl von Dynam's wasn't buttons. It was a shoelace. Pretty neat." Oh. Something stirred in Tommy's mind. Vague, wholly nebulous. Tuppence was quicker. As soon as he retailed the conversation to her, she seized on the salient point. "A shoelace? Tommy, that explains it." "What?" "Betty, you idiot. Don't you remember that funny thing she did in my room, taking out my laces and soaking them in water? I thought at the time it was a funny thing to think of doing, but of course she'd seen Carl do it and was imitating him. He couldn't risk her talking about it, and arranged with that woman for her to be kidnapped." Tommy said, "Then that's cleared up." "Yes. It's nice when things begin to fall into shape. One can put them behind you and get on a bit." "We need to get on," Tuppence nodded. The times were gloomy indeed. France had astonishingly and suddenly capitulated to the bewilderment and dismay of her own people. The destination of the French navy was in doubt. Now the coasts of France were entirely in the hands of Germany, and the talk of invasion was no longer a remote contingency. Tommy said, "Carl von Dynam was only a link in the chain. Mrs. Perenna's the fountainhead." "Yes, we've got to get the goods on her, but it won't be easy." "No. After all, if she's the brains of the whole thing, one can't expect it to be." "So, M is Mrs. Perenna." Tommy supposed she must be. He said slowly, "You really think the girl isn't in this at all?" "I'm quite sure of it." Tommy sighed. "Well, you should know. But if so, it's tough luck on her. First the man she loves, then her mother. She's not going to have much left, is she?" "Well, we can't help that." "Yes, but supposing we're wrong, that M or N is someone else?" Tuppence said rather coldly, "So you're still harping on that. Are you sure it isn't a case of wishful thinking?
What do you mean?
Sheila Perenna. That's what I mean.
Aren't you being rather absurd, Tuppence?
No, I'm not. She's got round you, Tommy, just like any other man.
Tommy replied angrily,
not at all.
It's simply that I've got my own ideas.
Which are?
I think I'll keep them to myself for a bit.
We'll see which of us is right.
Well, I think we've got to go all out after Mrs. Perenna, find out where she goes, whom she meets, everything.
There must be a link somewhere.
You'd better put Albert onto her this afternoon.
Oh, you can do that, I'm busy.
Why? What are you doing?
Tommy said, I'm playing golf.
Chapter 9
Seems quite like old times, doesn't it, madam? Said Albert.
He beamed happily. Though now in his middle years, running somewhat to fat, Albert had still the romantic boy's heart which had first led him into associations with Tommy and Tuppence in their young and adventurous days.
Remember how you first came across me? Demanded Albert.
Clean into the brasses I was, in those top-notch flats.
Coo, wasn't that all Porter a nasty bit of goods?
Always on to me he was.
And the day you come along and strung me a tale,
pack of lies it was too, all about a crook called Reddy Rita.
Not but what some of it didn't turn out to be true.
And since then, as you might say, I've never looked back.
Many's the adventures we had afore we all settled down, so to speak.
Albert sighed, and by a natural association of ideas, Tuppence inquired after the health of Mrs. Albert.
Oh, the missus is all right, but she doesn't take to the Welsh much, she says. She thinks they ought to learn proper English.
And as for raids, why, they've had two there already, and holes in the field that you could put a motor car in, so she says.
So, how's that for safety?
Might as well be in Kennington, she says, where she wouldn't have to see all the melancholy trees, and could get good clean milk in a bottle.
I don't know, said Tuppence, suddenly stricken, that we ought to get you into this, Albert.
Nonsense, madam, said Albert. Didn't I try and join up, and they were so haughty they wouldn't look at me. Wait for my age group to be called up, they said, and me in the pink of health, and only too eager to get at them perishing Germans, if you'll excuse the language. Just you tell me how I can put a spoke in their wheel and spoil their goings-on, and I'm there. Fifth column, that's what we're up against, so the papers say, though what's happened to the other four they don't mention. But the long and the short of it is, I'm ready to assist you and Captain Beresford in any way you like to indicate.
Good. Now, I'll tell you what we want you to do.
How long have you known Bletchley? Asked Tommy, as he stepped off the tee and watched with approval his ball leaping down the centre of the fairway.
Commander Haydock, who had also done a good drive, had a pleased expression on his face as he shouldered his clubs and replied,
Bletchley? Oh, let me see. Oh, about 9 months or so?
He came here last autumn.
Friend of friends of yours, I think you said?
Tommy suggested mendaciously.
Did I?
The commander looked a little surprised.
No, don't think so. Rather fancy I met him here at the club.
Bit of a mystery man, I gather.
The commander was clearly surprised this time.
Mystery man? Old Bletchley?
He sounded frankly incredulous. Tommy sighed inwardly. He supposed he was imagining things. He played his next shot and topped it. Haydock had a good iron shot that stopped just short of the green. As he rejoined the other, he said,
What on earth makes you call Bletchley a mystery man?
I should have said he was a painfully prosaic chap.
Typical army.
Bit set in his ideas and all that.
Narrow life in army life, but mystery?
Tommy said vaguely. Well, I just got the idea from something somebody said. They got down to the business of putting. The commander won the hole.
3 up and 2 to play, he remarked with satisfaction.
Then, as Tommy had hoped, his mind, free of the preoccupation of the match, harked back to what Tommy had said.
What sort of mystery do you mean? He asked.
Tommy shrugged his shoulders.
Oh, it was just that nobody seemed to know much about him. He was in the Rugbyshires.
Oh, you know that definitely.
Well, I don't know myself. I say, Meadows, what's the idea? Nothing wrong about Bletchley, is there?
No, of course not. Tommy's disclaimer came hastily. He had started his hair. He could now sit back and watch the commander's mind chasing after it.
Always struck me as an almost absurdly typical sort of chap, said Haydock.
Oh, just so.
Ah, yeah, see what you mean. Bit too much of a type, perhaps.
I'm leading the witness, thought Tommy. Still, perhaps something may crop up out of the old boy's mind.
Yes, I do see what you mean, the commander went on thoughtfully. And now I come to think of it, I've never actually come across anyone who knew Bletchley before he came down here. He doesn't have any old pals to stay. Nothing of that kind.
Ah, said Tommy, and added, shall we play the bye? Might as well get a bit more exercise. It's a lovely evening.
They drove off, then separated to play their next shots. When they met again on the green, Haydock said abruptly,
tell me what you heard about him.
Oh, nothing, nothing at all. No need to be cautious with me, Meadows. I hear all sorts of rumours, you understand? Everyone comes to me. I'm known to be pretty keen on the subject.
What's the idea? That Bletchley isn't what he seems to be?
It was only the merest suggestion.
What do they think he is, a Hun?
Nonsense. The man's as English as you and I.
Oh, yes, I'm quite sure he's all right.
Why, he's always yelling for more foreigners to be interned.
Look how violent he was against that young German chap.
Quite right, too, it seems. I heard unofficially from the chief constable that they found enough to hang von Deinem a dozen times over. He'd got a scheme to poison the water supply of the whole country, and he was actually working out a new gas. Working on it in one of our factories, my God. The short-sightedness of our people. Fancy letting the fellow inside the place to begin with. Believe anything our government would. A young fellow has only to come to this country just before the war starts and whine a bit about persecution, and they shut both eyes and let him into all our secrets. They were just as dense about that fellow Hahn.
Tommy had no intention of letting the commander run ahead on the well-grooved track. He deliberately missed a putt.
Hard lines, cried Haydock.
He played a careful shot. The ball rolled into the hole.
My hole. Bit off your game today. What were we talking about?
Tommy said firmly.
Oh, about Bletchley. Being perfectly all right.
Oh, of course, of course. I wonder now. I did hear a rather funny story about him. Didn't think anything of it at the time.
Here, to Tommy's annoyance, they were hailed by two other men. The four returned to the clubhouse together and had drinks. After that, the commander looked at his watch and remarked that he and Meadows must be getting along. Tommy had accepted an invitation to supper with the commander. Smuggler's Rest was in its usual condition of apple pie order. A tall, middle-aged manservant waited on them with the professional deftness of a waiter. Such perfect service was somewhat unusual to find outside of a London restaurant. When the man had left the room, Tommy commented on the fact.
Yes, I was lucky to get Appledore.
How did you get hold of him?
Oh, he answered an advertisement, as a matter of fact. He had excellent references. He was clearly far superior to any of the others who applied and asked remarkably low wages. I engaged him on the spot.
Tommy said with a laugh, the war has certainly robbed us of most of our good restaurant service. Practically all good waiters were foreigners. It doesn't seem to come naturally to the Englishman.
Bit too servile, that's why. Buying and scraping doesn't come kindly to the English bulldog.
Sitting outside, sipping coffee, Tommy gently asked, what was it you were going to say on the links? Something about a funny story, apropos of Bletchley.
What was it now?
Oh, hello, did you see that?
Light being shown out to sea. Where's my telescope?
Tommy sighed. The stars in their courses seemed to be fighting against him. The commander fussed into the house and out again, sweeping the horizon with his glass, outlined a whole system of signalling by the enemy to likely spots on shore, most of the evidence for which seemed to be non-existent, and proceeded to give a gloomy picture of a successful invasion in the near future.
No organisation, no proper coordination. You're an LDV yourself, Meadows. You know what it's like. With a man like old Andrews in charge.
This was well-worn ground. It was Commander Haydock's pet grievance. He ought to be the man in command, and he was quite determined to oust Colonel Andrews if it could possibly be done. The manservant brought out whiskey and liqueurs, while the commander was still holding forth.
And we're still honeycombed with spies, riddled with them. It was the same in the last war, hairdressers, waiters.
Tommy, leaning back, catching the profile of Appledore as the latter hovered, deft-footed, thought, waiters? You could call that fellow Fritz easier than Appledore.
Well, why not?
The fellow spoke perfect English, true, but then many Germans did. They had perfected their English by years in English restaurants, and the racial type was not unlike. Fair-haired, blue-eyed, often betrayed by the shape of the head. Yes, the head. Where had he seen a head lately? He spoke on an impulse. The words fitted in appropriately enough with what the commander was just saying. All these damned forms to fill in? No good at all, Meadows. Series of idiotic questions. Tommy said, I know, such as, what is your name? Answer N or M. There was a swerve, a crash. Appledore, the perfect servant, had blundered. A stream of creme de menthe soaked over Tommy's cuff and hand. The man stammered, sorry, sir. Haydock blazed out in fury. You damn clumsy fool! What the hell do you think you're doing? His usually red face was quite purple with anger. Tommy thought, talk of an army temper. Navy beats it hollow. Haydock continued with a stream of abuse. Appledore was abject in apologies. Tommy felt uncomfortable for the man. But suddenly, as though by magic, the commander's wrath passed, and he was his hearty self again. Come along and have a wash. Beastly stuff. It would be the creme de menthe. Tommy followed him indoors, and was soon in the sumptuous bathroom with the innumerable gadgets. He carefully washed off the sticky, sweet stuff. The commander talked from the bedroom next door. He sounded a little shame-faced. Afraid I let myself go a bit. Poor old Appledore. He knows that I let go a bit more than I mean, always. Tommy turned from the wash basin, drying his hands. He did not notice that a cake of soap had slipped onto the floor. His foot stepped on it. The linoleum was highly polished. A moment later, Tommy was doing a wild ballet dancer step. He shot across the bathroom, arms outstretched. One came up against the right-hand tap of the bath, the other pushed heavily against the side of a small bathroom cabinet. It was an extravagant gesture, never likely to be achieved except by some catastrophe such as had just occurred. His foot skidded heavily against the end panel of the bath. The thing happened like a conjuring trick. The bath slid out from the wall, turning on a concealed pivot. Tommy found himself looking into a dim recess. He had no doubt whatever as to what occupied that recess. It contained a transmitting wireless apparatus. The commander's voice had ceased. He appeared suddenly in the doorway, and with a click, several things fell into place in Tommy's brain. Had he been blind up to now? That jovial, florid face, the face of a hearty Englishman, was only a mask. Why had he not seen it all along for what it was? The face of a bad-tempered, overbearing Prussian officer. Tommy was helped, no doubt, by the incident that had just happened, for it recalled to him another incident. A Prussian bully turning on a subordinate and berating him with the Junker's true insolence. So had Commander Haydock turned on his subordinate that evening when the latter had been taken unawares. And it all fitted in. It fitted like magic. The double bluff. The enemy agent Hahn sent first, preparing the place, employing foreign workmen, drawing attention to himself, and proceeding finally to the next stage in the plan. His own unmasking by the gallant British sailor Commander Haydock. And then how natural that the Englishman should buy the place and tell the story to everyone, boring them by constant repetition. And so, N, securely settled in his appointed place, with sea communications and his secret wireless and his staff officers at Sanssouci close at hand, is ready to carry out Germany's plan. Tommy was unable to resist a flash of genuine admiration. The whole thing had been so perfectly planned. He himself had never suspected Haydock. He had accepted Haydock as the genuine article. Only a completely unforeseen accident had given the show away. All this passed through Tommy's mind in a few seconds. He knew only too well that he must necessarily be in deadly peril. If only he could act the part of the credulous, thick-headed Englishman well enough. He turned to Haydock with what he hoped was a natural-sounding laugh. By Jove! One never stops getting surprises at your place. Was this another of Hahn's little gadgets? You didn't show me this the other day. Haydock was standing still. There was a tensity about his big body as he stood there blocking the door. More than a match for me, Tommy thought. And there's that confounded servant, too. For an instant, Haydock stood as though moulded in stone. Then he relaxed. He said with a laugh, Damn funny, Meadows. You went skating over the floor like a ballet dancer. Don't suppose a thing like that would happen once in 1,000 times. Dry your hands and come into the other room. Tommy followed him out of the bathroom. He was alert and tense in every muscle. Somehow or other, He must get safely away from this house with his knowledge. Could he succeed in fooling Haydock? The latter's tone sounded natural enough. With an arm round Tommy's shoulders, a casual arm perhaps, or perhaps not, Haydock shepherded him into the sitting room. Turning, he shut the door behind them.
Look here, old boy, I've got something to say to you.
His voice was friendly, natural, just a shade embarrassed. He motioned to Tommy to sit down.
It's a bit awkward, he said. Upon my word, it's a bit awkward. Nothing for it, though, but to take you into my confidence. Only you'll have to keep dark about it, Meadows. You understand that?
Tommy endeavoured to throw an expression of eager interest upon his face. Haydock sat down and drew his chair confidentially close.
You see, Meadows, it's like this. Nobody's supposed to know, but I'm working on intelligence. MI-42BX, that's my department. Ever heard of it?
Tommy shook his head and intensified the eager expression.
Well, it's pretty secret. Kind of in a ring, if you know what I mean. We transmit certain information from here, but it would be absolutely fatal if that fact got out. You understand?
Of course, said Mr. Meadows. Most interesting. Well, naturally, you can count on me not to say a word.
Yes, that's absolutely vital. The whole thing is extremely confidential.
Oh, I quite understand. Your work must be most thrilling, really most thrilling. I should like so much to know more about it, but I suppose I mustn't ask that.
No, I'm afraid not. It's very secret, you see.
Oh, yes, I see.
I really do apologize. A most extraordinary accident.
He thought to himself, surely he can't be taken in. He can't imagine I'd fall for this stuff. It seemed incredible to him. Then he reflected that vanity had been the undoing of many men. Commander Haydock was a clever man, a big fellow. This miserable chap Meadows was a stupid Britisher, the sort of man who would believe anything. If only Haydock continued to think that. Tommy went on talking. He displayed keen interest and curiosity. He knew he mustn't ask questions, but he supposed Commander Haydock's work must be very dangerous. Had he ever been in Germany, working there? Haydock replied genially enough. He was intensely the British sailor now. The Prussian officer had disappeared. But Tommy, watching him with a new vision, wondered how he could ever have been deceived. The shape of the head, the line of the jaw, nothing British about them. Presently, Mr. Meadows rose. It was the supreme test. Would it go off all right?
I really must be going now. Getting quite late. Feel terribly apologetic, but can assure you will not say a word to anybody.
It's now or never. Will he let me go or not? I must be ready. A straight to his jaw would be best. Talking amiably and with pleasurable excitement, Mr. Meadows edged towards the door. He was in the hall. He had opened the front door. Through the door on the right, he caught a glimpse of Appledore setting the breakfast things ready on a tray for the morning. The damn fools were going to let him get away with it. The two men stood in the porch, chatting, fixing up another match for next Saturday. Tommy thought grimly, there'll be no next Saturday for you, my boy. Voices came from the road outside. Two men returning from a tramp on the headland. They were men that both Tommy and the commander knew slightly. Tommy hailed them. They stopped. Haydock and he exchanged a few words with them, all standing at the gate. Then Tommy waved a genial farewell to his host and stepped off with the two men. He had got away with it. Haydock, damn fool, had been taken in. He heard Haydock go back to his house, go in and shut the door. Tommy tramped carefully down the hill with his two newfound friends. Weather looked likely to change. Old Monroe was off his game again. That fellow Ashby refused to join the LDV, said it was no damn good. Pretty thick, that. Young Marsh, the assistant caddymaster, was a conscientious objector. Didn't Meadows think that matter ought to be put up to the committee? There had been a pretty bad raid on Southampton the night before last. Quite a lot of damage done. What did Meadows think about Spain? Were they turning nasty? Of course, ever since the French collapse. Tommy could have shouted aloud, such good, casual, normal talk. A stroke of providence that these two men had turned up just at that moment. He said goodbye to them at the gates of Sanssouci and turned in. He walked up the drive, whistling softly to himself. He had just turned the dark corner by the rhododendrons when something heavy descended on his head. He crashed forward, pitching into blackness and oblivion. Chapter 10.
Did you say three spades, Mrs. Blenkinsop?
Yes, Mrs. Blenkinsop had said three spades. Mrs. Sprott, returning breathless from the telephone, said,
And they've changed the time of the ARP exam again. It's too bad.
And demanded to have the bidding again. Miss Minton, as usual, delayed things by ceaseless reiterations.
Was it two clubs, I said? Are you sure? I rather thought you know that it might have been one. No trump. Oh, yes, of course, I remember now. Mrs. Cayley said one heart, didn't she? And I was going to say no trump, although I hadn't quite got the count, but I do think one should play a plucky game. And then Mrs. Cayley said one heart, and so I had to go two clubs. I always think it's so difficult when one has two short suits.
Sometimes, Tuppence thought to herself, it would save time if Miss Minton just put her hand down on the table to show them all. She was quite incapable of not telling exactly what was in it.
So, now we've got it right,
said Miss Minton triumphantly. One heart, two clubs.
Two spades, said Tuppence. I passed, didn't I? Said Mrs. Sprott.
They looked at Mrs. Cayley, who was leaning forward, listening. Miss Minton took up the tale.
Then Mrs. Cayley said two hearts, and I said three diamonds. And I said three spades, said Tuppence. Pass, said Mrs. Sprott.
Mrs. Cayley sat in silence. At last she seemed to become aware that everyone was looking at her.
Oh dear, she flushed. I'm so sorry. I thought perhaps Mr. Cayley needed me. I hope he's all right out there on the terrace.
She looked from one to the other of them.
Oh, perhaps, if you don't mind, I'd better just go and see. I heard rather an odd noise. Perhaps he's dropped his book.
She fluttered out of the window. Tuppence gave an exasperated sigh. She ought to have a string tied to her wrist, she said. Then he could pull it when he wanted her.
Such a devoted wife, said Miss Minton. It's very nice to see, isn't it?
Is it? Said Tuppence, who was feeling far from good-tempered. The three women sat in silence for a minute or two.
Where's Sheila tonight?
Asked Miss Minton.
She went to the pictures, said Mrs. Sprott.
Where's Mrs. Perenna? Asked Tuppence.
Oh, she said she was going to do accounts in her room, said Miss Minton. Poor dear, so tiring, doing accounts. Oh, she's not been doing accounts all evening, said Mrs. Sprott, because she came in just now when I was telephoning in the hall.
I wonder where she'd been, said Miss Minton, whose life was taken up by such small wonderments. Oh, not to the pictures. They wouldn't be out yet.
She hadn't got a hat on, said Mrs. Sprott, nor a coat. Her hair was all anyhow, and I think she'd been running or something, quite out of breath. She ran upstairs without a word, and she glared, positively glared at me, and I'm sure I hadn't done anything.
Mrs. Cayley reappeared at the window.
Fancy, she said. Mr. Cayley has walked all round the garden by himself. He quite enjoyed it, he said. Such a mild night.
She sat down again.
Let me see. Do you think we could have the bidding over again?
Tuppence suppressed a rebellious sigh. They had the bidding all over again, and she was left to play three spades. Mrs. Perenna came in just as they were cutting for the next deal.
Did you enjoy your walk?
Asked Mrs. Minton. Mrs. Perenna stared at her. It was a fierce and unpleasant stare. She said, I've not been out.
Oh, I thought Mrs. Sprott said you'd come in just now.
Mrs. Perenna said, I just went outside to look at the weather. Her tone was disagreeable. She threw a hostile glance at the meek Mrs. Sprott, who flushed and looked frightened.
Just fancy, said Mrs. Cayley, contributing her item of news. Mr. Cayley walked all round the garden.
Mrs. Perenna said sharply, Why did he do that?
Mrs. Cayley said, It is such a mild night. He hasn't even put on his second muffler, and he still doesn't want to come in. I do hope he won't get a chill.
Mrs. Perenna said, There are worse things than chills. A bomb might come at any minute and blow us all to bits.
Oh dear, I hope it won't.
Do you? I rather wish it would. Mrs. Perenna went out of the window. The four bridge players stared after her.
She seems very odd tonight, said Mrs. Sprott.
Miss Minton leaned forward.
You don't think, do you?
She looked from side to side. They all leaned nearer together. Miss Minton said, in a sibilant whisper,
You don't suspect, do you, that she drinks?
Oh, dear,
said Mrs. Cayley.
I wonder now. Oh, that would explain it. She really is so unaccountable sometimes. What do you think, Mrs. Blenkinsop?
Oh, I didn't really think so. I think she's worried about something. It's your call, Mrs. Sprott.
Oh, dear me, what shall I say?
Asked Mrs. Sprott, surveying her hand. Nobody volunteered to tell her, though Miss Minton, who had been gazing with unabashed interest into her hand, might have been in a position to advise.
That isn't Betty, is it?
Demanded Mrs. Sprott, her head upraised. No, it isn't, said Tuppence firmly. She felt that she might scream unless they got on with the game. Mrs. Sprott looked at her hand vaguely, her mind still apparently maternal. Then she said,
Oh, one diamond, I think.
The call went round. Mrs. Cayley led.
When in doubt, lead a trump, they say,
she twittered, and laid down the nine of diamonds. A deep, genial voice said,
"'Tis the curse of Scotland that you've played there."
Mrs. O'Rourke stood in the window. She was breathing deeply. Her eyes were sparkling. She looked sly and malicious. She advanced into the room.
"'Just a nice, quiet game of bridge, is it?'
"'What's that in your hand?' asked Mrs. Sprott with interest.
"'Tis a hammer,' said Mrs. O'Rourke amiably. "'I found it lying in the drive. No doubt somebody left it there.'
"'It's a funny place to leave a hammer,' said Mrs. Sprott doubtfully.
"'It is that,' agreed Mrs. O'Rourke.
She seemed in a particularly good humour. Swinging the hammer by its handle, she went out into the hall.
"'Oh, let me see,' said Miss Minton. "'What's trumps?'
The game proceeded for 5 minutes without further interruption, and then Major Bletchley came in. He had been to the pictures, and proceeded to tell them in detail the plot of Wandering Minstrel, laid in the reign of Richard I. The Major, as a military man, criticised at some length the crusading battle scenes. The rubber was not finished, for Mrs. Cayley, looking at her watch, discovered the lateness of the hour with shrill little cries of horror, and rushed out to Mr. Cayley. The latter, as a neglected invalid, enjoyed himself a great deal, coughing in a sepulchral manner, shivering dramatically, and saying several times,
"'Oh, quite all right, my dear. I hope you enjoyed your game. It doesn't matter about me at all, even if I have caught a severe chill. What does it really matter? There's a war on.'
At breakfast the next morning, Tuppence was aware at once of a certain tension in the atmosphere. Mrs. Perenna, her lips pursed very tightly together, was distinctly acrid in the few remarks she made. She left the room with what could only be described as a flounce. Major Bletchley, spreading marmalade thickly on his toast, gave vent to a deep chuckle.
"'Touch of frost in the air?' he remarked. "'Well, well. Only to be expected, I suppose.'
"'Why? What has happened?'
demanded Miss Minton, leaning forward eagerly, her thin neck twitching with pleasurable anticipation.
"'I don't know that I ought to tell tales out of school,'
replied the Major irritatingly.
"'Oh, Major Bletchley. Oh, do tell us,' said Tuppence.
Major Bletchley looked thoughtfully at his audience, Miss Minton, Mrs. Blenkinsop, Mrs. Cayley, and Mrs. O'Rourke. Mrs. Sprott and Betty had just left. He decided to talk.
"'It's Meadows,' he said. "'Beat out on the tiles all night. Hasn't come home yet.'
"'What?'
exclaimed Tuppence. Major Bletchley threw her a pleased and malicious glance. He enjoyed the discomfiture of the designing widow.
"'Bit of a gay dog, Meadows,' he chortled. "'The Perenna's annoyed, naturally.'
"'Oh, dear,'
said Miss Minton, flushing painfully. Mrs. Cayley looked shocked. Mrs. O'Rourke merely chuckled.
"'Mrs. Perenna told me already,' she said. "'Ah, well, the boys will be the boys.'
Miss Minton said eagerly,
"'Oh, but surely, perhaps Mr. Meadows has met with an accident. In the blackout, you know.'
"'Good old blackout,' said Major Bletchley. "'Responsible for a lot, I can tell you.' It's been an eye-opener being on patrol in the LDV, stopping cars and all that. The amount of wives just seeing their husbands home and different names on their identity cards, and the wife or husband coming back the other way alone a few hours later.
He chuckled. then quickly composed his face as he received the full blast of Mrs. Blenkinsop's disapproving stare.
"Human nature! Oh, a bit humorous, eh?" he said appeasingly.
"Oh, but Mr. Meadows," bleated Miss Minton, "he may really have met with an accident, been knocked down by a car."
"Well, that'll be his story, I expect," said the Major. "Car hit him, knocked him out, and he came to in the morning."
"Well, he may have been taken to hospital."
"Well, they'd have let us know. After all, he's carrying his identity card, isn't he?"
"Oh, dear," said Mrs. Cayley. "I wonder what Mr. Cayley will say."
This rhetorical question remained unanswered. Tuppence, rising with an assumption of affronted dignity, got up and left the room. Major Bletchley chuckled when the door closed behind her.
"Poor old Meadows," he said. "The fair widow's annoyed about it. Thought she'd got her hooks into him."
"Oh, Major Bletchley," bleated Miss Minton.
Major Bletchley winked.
"Remember your Dickens? Beware of widows, Sammy."
Tuppence was a little upset by Tommy's unannounced absence, but she tried to reassure herself. He might possibly have struck some hot trail and gone off upon it. The difficulties of communication with each other under such circumstances had been foreseen by them both, and they had agreed that the other one was not to be unduly perturbed by unexplained absences. They had arranged certain contrivances between them for such emergencies. Mrs. Perenna had, according to Mrs. Sprott, been out last night. The vehemence of her own denial of the fact only made that absence of hers more interesting to speculate upon. It was possible that Tommy had trailed her on her secret errand and had found something worth following up. Doubtless he would communicate with Tuppence in his special way, or else turn up very shortly. Nevertheless, Tuppence was unable to avoid a certain feeling of uneasiness. She decided that in her role of Mrs. Blenkinsop it would be perfectly natural to display some curiosity and even anxiety. She went, without more ado, in search of Mrs. Perenna. Mrs. Perenna was inclined to be short with her upon the subject. She made it clear that such conduct on the part of one of her lodgers was not to be condoned or glossed over. Tuppence exclaimed breathlessly,
"Oh, but he may have met with an accident. I'm sure he must have done. He's not at all that sort of man, not at all loose in his ideas or anything of that kind. He must have been run down by a car or something."
"We shall probably soon hear one way or another," said Mrs. Perenna.
But the day wore on, and there was no sign of Mr. Meadows. In the evening, Mrs. Perenna, urged on by the pleas of her boarders, agreed extremely reluctantly to ring up the police. A sergeant called at the house with a notebook and took particulars. Certain facts were then elicited. Mr. Meadows had left Commander Haydock's house at 10:30. From there, he had walked with a Mr. Walters and a Dr. Curtis as far as the gates of Sanssouci, where he had said goodbye to them and turned into the drive. From that moment, Mr. Meadows seemed to have disappeared into space. In Tuppence's mind, two possibilities emerged from this. When walking up the drive, Tommy may have seen Mrs. Perenna coming towards him, have slipped into the bushes, and then have followed her. Having observed her rendezvous with some unknown person, he might then have followed the latter, whilst Mrs. Perenna returned to Sanssouci. In that case, he was probably very much alive and busy on a trail, in which case the well-meant endeavours of the police to find him might prove most embarrassing. The other possibility was not so pleasant. It resolved itself into two pictures. One, that of Mrs. Perenna returning out of breath and dishevelled. The other one would not be laid aside. A picture of Mrs. O'Rourke standing smiling in the window, holding a heavy hammer. That hammer had horrible possibilities. For what should a hammer be doing lying outside? As to who had wielded it, that was more difficult. A good deal depended on the exact time when Mrs. Perenna had re-entered the house. It was certainly somewhere in the neighbourhood of 10:30, but none of the bridge party happened to have noted the time exactly. Mrs. Perenna had declared vehemently that she had not been out except just to look at the weather. But one does not get out of breath just looking at the weather. It was clearly extremely vexing to her to have been seen by Mrs. Sprott. With ordinary luck, the four ladies might have been safely accounted for as busy playing bridge. What had the time been exactly? Tuppence found everybody extremely vague on the subject. If the time agreed, Mrs. Perenna was clearly the most likely suspect. but there were other possibilities. Of the inhabitants of Sanssouci, three had been out at the time of Tommy's return. Major Bletchley had been out at the cinema, but he had been to it alone, and the way that he had insisted on retailing the whole picture so meticulously might suggest to a suspicious mind that he was deliberately establishing an alibi. Then there was the valetudinarian Mr. Cayley, who had gone for a walk all round the garden. But for the accident of Mrs. Cayley's anxiety over her spouse, no one might have heard of that walk, and might have imagined Mr. Cayley to have remained securely encased in rugs like a mummy in his chair on the terrace. Rather unlike him, really, to risk the contamination of the night air so long. And then there was Mrs. O'Rourke herself, swinging the hammer and smiling. "What's the matter, Deb? You're looking worried, my sweet." Deborah Beresford started, and then laughed, looking frankly into Tony Marsden's sympathetic brown eyes. She liked Tony. He had brains, was one of the most brilliant beginners in the coding department, and was thought likely to go far. Deborah enjoyed her job, though she found it made somewhat strenuous demands on her powers of concentration. It was tiring, but it was worthwhile, and it gave her a pleasant feeling of importance. This was real work, not just hanging about a hospital waiting for a chance to nurse. She said, "Oh, nothing. Just family, you know." "Families are a bit trying. What's yours been up to?" "Oh, it's my mother. To tell the truth, I'm just a bit worried about her." "Why? What's happened?" "Well, you see, she went down to Cornwall, to a frightfully trying old aunt of mine, 78 and completely gaga."
"Sounds grim," commented the young man sympathetically.
"Yes, it really was very noble of mother. But she was rather hipped anyway, because nobody seemed to want her in this war. Of course, she nursed and did things in the last one, but it's all quite different now, and they don't want these middle-aged people. They want people who are young and on the spot. Well, as I say, mother got a bit hipped over it all, and so she went off down to Cornwall to stay with Aunt Gracie, and she's been doing a bit in the garden. Extra vegetable growing and all that."
"Quite sound," commented Tony.
"Yes, much the best thing she could do. She's quite active still, you know," said Deborah kindly.
"Well, that sounds all right."
"Oh, yes, it isn't that. I was quite happy about her. Had a letter only 2 days ago, sounding quite cheerful."
"Well, what's the trouble, then?"
"The trouble is that I told Charles, who was going down to see his people in that part of the world, to go and look her up. And he did. And she wasn't there."
"Wasn't there?"
"No. And she hadn't been there either. Not at all, apparently."
Tony looked a little embarrassed. "Rather odd," he murmured. "Your father?"
"Carrot Top? Oh, he's in Scotland somewhere. In one of those dreadful ministries where they file papers in triplicate all day long."
"Well, your mother hasn't gone to join him, perhaps?"
"She can't. He's in one of those area things where wives can't go."
"Oh. Well, I suppose she's just sloped off somewhere."
Tony was decidedly embarrassed now, especially with Deborah's large, worried eyes fixed plaintively upon him. "Yes, but why? So queer. All her letters, talking about Aunt Gracie and the garden and everything."
I know, said Tony hastily. "Of course, she'd want you to think, I mean, nowadays, well, people do slope off now and again, if you know what I mean."
Deborah's gaze, from being plaintive, became suddenly wrathful.
"If you think Mother's just gone off weekending with someone, you're absolutely wrong. Absolutely. Mother and father are devoted to each other, really devoted. It's quite a joke in the family. She'd never..."
Tony said hastily.
"Oh, of course not. Sorry, I really didn't mean..."
Deborah, her wrath appeased, creased her forehead.
"The odd thing is that someone the other day said they'd seen Mother in Leehampton, of all places. Of course, I said it couldn't be her because she was in Cornwall, but now I wonder..."
Tony, his match held to a cigarette, paused suddenly, and the match went out.
"Leehampton?" he said sharply. "Yes, just the last place you could imagine Mother going off to. Nothing to do, and all old colonels and maiden ladies."
"Doesn't sound a likely spot, certainly," said Tony. He lit his cigarette and asked casually, "What did your mother do in the last war?" Deborah answered mechanically,
"Oh,
nursed a bit, and drove a general. Army, I mean, not a bus. All the usual sort of things. Oh, I thought perhaps she'd been like you, in the intelligence. Oh, Mother would never have had the head for this sort of work. I believe, though, that she and Father did do something in the sleuthing line. Secret papers and master spies, that sort of thing. Of course, the darlings exaggerated all a good deal, make it all sound as though it had been frightfully important. We don't really encourage them to talk about it much, because, you know, what one's family is. The same old story over and over again.
Oh, rather, said Tony Marsden heartily. I quite agree.
It was on the following day that Deborah, returning to her digs, was puzzled by something unfamiliar in the appearance of her room. It took her a few minutes to fathom what it was. Then she rang the bell and demanded angrily of her landlady what had happened to the big photograph that always stood on the top of the chest of drawers. Mrs. Rowley was aggrieved and resentful. She couldn't say, she was sure. She hadn't touched it herself. Maybe Gladys. But Gladys also denied having removed it. The man had been about the gas, she said hopefully. But Deborah declined to believe that an employee of the gas company would have taken a fancy to and removed the portrait of a middle-aged lady. Far more likely, in Deborah's opinion, that Gladys had smashed the photograph frame and had hastily removed all traces of the crime to the dustbin. Deborah didn't make a fuss about it. Sometime or other, she'd get her mother to send her another photo. She thought to herself, with rising vexation, "What's the old darling up to? She might tell me." Of course, it's absolute nonsense to suggest, as Tony did, that she's gone off with someone. But all the same, it's very queer.
Chapter 11. It was Tuppence's turn to talk to the fisherman on the end of the pier. She had hoped against hope that Mr. Grant might have had some comfort for her, but her hopes were soon dashed. He stated definitely that no news of any kind had come from Tommy. Tuppence said, trying her best to make her voice assured and businesslike, "There's no reason to suppose that anything has happened to him."
"None whatever."
"But let's suppose it has."
"What?"
"I'm saying, supposing it has. What about you?"
"Oh, I see."
"Why, I carry on, of course." "That's the stuff. There is time to weep after the battle. We're in the thick of the battle now, and time is short. One piece of information you brought us has been proved correct. You overheard a reference to the 4th. The 4th referred to is the 4th of next month. It's the date fixed for the big attack on this country."
"You're sure?"
"Fairly sure. They're methodical people, our enemies. All their plans neatly made and worked out. Wish we could say the same of ourselves. Planning isn't our strong point. Yes, the 4th is the day. All these raids aren't the real thing. They're mostly reconnaissance, testing our defences and our reflexes to air attack. On the 4th comes the real thing."
"But if you know that..."
"We know the day is fixed. We know, or think we know, roughly where, but we may be wrong there. We're as ready as we can be, but it's the old story of the Siege of Troy. They knew, as we know, all about the forces without. It's the forces within we want to know about, the men in the wooden horse, for they are the men who can deliver up the keys of the fortress. A dozen men in high places, in command, in vital spots, by issuing conflicting orders, can throw the country into just that state of confusion necessary for the German plan to succeed. We've got to have inside information in time." Tuppence said despairingly,
"I feel so futile, so inexperienced."
"Oh, you needn't worry about that. We've got experienced people working. All the experience and talent we've got. But when there's treachery within, we can't tell who to trust. You and Beresford are the irregular forces. Nobody knows about you. That's why you've got a chance to succeed. That's why you have succeeded, up to a certain point."
"Can't you put some of your people onto Mrs. Perenna? There must be some of them you can trust absolutely."
"Oh, we've done that. Working from information received that Mrs. Perenna is a member of the IRA with anti-British sympathies. That's true enough, by the way. But we can't get proof of anything further. Not of the vital facts we want. So stick to it, Mrs. Beresford. Go on and do your darndest."
"The 4th, said Tuppence. "That's barely a week ahead. It's a week exactly. Tuppence clenched her hands. We must get something. I say we, because I believe Tommy is onto something, and that's why he hasn't come back. He's following up a lead. If I could only get something too. I wonder how. If I... She frowned, planning a new form of attack.
You see, Albert, it's a possibility.
Well, I see what you mean, madam, of course, but I don't like the idea very much, I must say.
I think it might work.
Well, yes, madam, but it's exposing yourself to attack. That's what I don't like. And I'm sure the master wouldn't like it. But we've tried all the usual ways. That is to say, we've done what we could, keeping under cover. It seems to me now the only chance is to come out into the open. You are aware, madam, that thereby you may be sacrificing an advantage.
You're frightfully BBC in your language this afternoon, Albert, said Tuppence, with some exasperation.
Albert looked slightly taken aback, and reverted to a more natural form of speech.
I was listening to a very interesting talk on pond life last night, he explained. We've no time to think about pond life now, said Tuppence.
Where's Captain Beresford? That's what I'd like to know.
So should I, said Tuppence, with a pang. Don't seem natural, his disappearing without a word. He ought to have tipped you the wink by now. That's why...
Yes, Albert?
Well, what I mean is, if he's come out in the open, perhaps you'd better not.
He paused to arrange his ideas and then went on.
I mean, they've blown the gaff on him, but they may not know about you. So it's up to you to keep under cover still.
I wish I could make up my mind, sighed Tuppence.
Which way were you thinking of managing it, madam?
Tuppence murmured thoughtfully.
I thought I might... lose a letter I'd written, make a lot of fuss about it, seem very upset. Then it would be found in the hall, and Beatrice would probably put it on the hall table. Then the right person would get a look at it.
What would be in the letter?
Oh, roughly that I'd been successful in discovering the identity of the person in question, and that I was to make a full report personally tomorrow. Then, you see, Albert, N or M would have to come out in the open and have a shot at eliminating me.
Oh, yeah. Maybe they'd manage it, too.
Not if I was on my guard. They'd have, I think, to decoy me away somewhere, some lonely spot. That's where you'd come in, because they don't know about you. I'd follow them up and catch them red-handed, so to speak.
Tuppence nodded.
That's the idea. I must think it out carefully. I'll meet you tomorrow.
Tuppence was just emerging from the local lending library with what had been recommended to her as a nice book clasped under her arm, when she was startled by a voice saying, Mrs. Beresford? She turned abruptly to see a tall, dark young man with an agreeable but slightly embarrassed smile. He said, I'm afraid you don't remember me. Tuppence was thoroughly used to the formula. She could have predicted with accuracy the words that were coming next. I came to the flat with Deborah one day. Deborah's friends, so many of them, and all to Tuppence looking singularly alike. Some dark, like this young man, some fair, an occasional red-haired one, but all cast in the same mould. Pleasant, well-mannered. Their hair, in Tuppence's view, just slightly too long. But when this was hinted, Deborah would say, Oh, mother, don't be so terribly 1916. I can't stand short hair. Annoying to have run across and been recognised by one of Deborah's young men just now. However, she could probably soon shake him off. I'm Anthony Marsden, explained the young man. Tuppence murmured mendaciously,
Oh, of course, and shook hands.
Tony Marsden went on,
I'm awfully glad to have found you, Mrs. Beresford. You see, I'm working at the same job as Deborah, and, as a matter of fact, something rather awkward has happened.
Yes, said Tuppence, what is it?
Well, you see, Deborah's found out that you're not down in Cornwall, as she thought, and that makes it a bit awkward, doesn't it, for you?
Don't bother, said Tuppence, concerned. How did she find out?
Tony Marsden explained.
He went on rather diffidently. Deborah, of course, has no idea of what you're really doing. He paused discreetly, and then went on. It's important, I imagine, that she shouldn't know. My job, actually, is rather the same line. I'm supposed to be just a beginner in the coding department, but really my instructions are to express views that are mildly fascist, admiration of the German system, insinuations that a working alliance with Hitler wouldn't be a bad thing, all that sort of thing, just to see what response I get. Now, there's a good deal of rot going on, you see, and we want to find out who's at the bottom of it. Rot everywhere, thought Tuppence. But as soon as Deb told me about you, continued the young man, I thought I'd better come straight down and warn you, so that you can cook up a likely story. You see, I happen to know what you're doing, and that it's of vital importance. It would be fatal if any hint of who you are got about. I thought perhaps you could make it seem as though you'd joined Captain Beresford in Scotland, or wherever he is. You might say that you've been allowed to work with him there.
I might do that, certainly, said Tuppence thoughtfully.
Tony Marsden said anxiously,
You don't think I'm butting in?
No, I'm very grateful to you. Tony said rather inconsequentially, I'm rather fond of Deborah.
Tuppence flashed him an amused, quick glance. How far away it seemed, that world of attentive young men, and Deb, with her rudeness to them, that never seemed to put them off. This young man was, she thought, quite an attractive specimen. She put aside what she called to herself peacetime thoughts, and concentrated on the present situation. After a moment or two, she said slowly,
My husband isn't in Scotland.
Isn't he?
No, he's down here with me, at least he was. Now he's disappeared.
Oh, I say, that's bad.
Or isn't it?
Was he onto something?
Tuppence nodded.
I think so. That's why I don't think that his disappearing like this is really a bad sign. I think sooner or later he'll communicate with me, in his own way.
She smiled a little. Tony said with some slight embarrassment,
Of course you know the game well, I expect.
But you ought to be careful.
Tuppence nodded.
I know what you mean. Beautiful heroines in books are always easily decoyed away. But Tommy and I have our methods.
We've got a slogan, she smiled. Penny plain and Tuppence coloured.
What?
The young man stared at her as though she had gone mad.
I ought to explain that my family nickname is Tuppence.
Oh, I see.
The young man's brow cleared.
Ingenious, what?
I hope so.
I don't want to butt in, but I couldn't help in any way.
Yes, said Tuppence thoughtfully.
I think perhaps you might.